Welcome back. I'm Bob DeGree, and we're having a look back into the past and maybe a little bit into the future of Andy Secker, a good friend of mine who's been, in my opinion, instrumental, and no pun intended or pun intended, to the growth of the bluegrass scene in Vermont for many years. And so we've been just talking about how he grew up in Chicago and how he started being influenced by music in Chicago. So I would like to ask you now, Andy, your first band that you played in, was that in Chicago?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So, I was really into the bluegrass music and learning how to play it, and I was playing the guitar, and there were a number of young players around, and we would get together, and I don't even remember exactly how this band formed, but we had a band with my friend Paul Ostroff, who was one of I mentioned earlier, the two guys who kind of turned me on to real traditional music was,
mm-hmm.
traditional folk music. And Paul was playing the mandolin at the time, and guy who lived not in our neighborhood but in Skokie, guy named Dan Zazoff, was a good guitar player. I think he had a D21, I think, a Brazilian, but without the fancy bindings of the, mm-hmm. D28. It was just a poor man's D28. And a banjo player who we all called Fat Wally, who was,
I'm sure he appreciated
fat.
That.
Well, he knew he was fat, and he was a good picker. Played solid Scruggs style and could play good and fast and hard. And
what year was this approximately?
About 63, I guess. 63, I think. I think I was... 63 was the end of my high school, my last... first half of 63. I was still in high school, and then I started college in the fall of 63. And so we had this band... Who else was there? We had no fiddle. I guess it was just the four of us. Wally, Dan, Paul, Danny Zazoff on guitar,
and you,
and me, and I was lagging behind all the others in playing abilities. And there was some guy in Chicago who made bass, one string basses. He would use a 5 gallon can of some kind, a drum,
mm-hmm.
steel, I guess, and he would build a little bass for it, a little four legs, whatever, and then had a neck coming up. The neck had a fingerboard, a fretboard on it, a slab of, I don't know if it was ebony, but it had a fretboard, and then it had one string. had the G string of a string bass, and it had a tuning peg up at the top, and it's a one string bass, and you just play a one string up and down, and they had one at the Old Town School of Folk Music that they had on their, when I mentioned the room where there would, yeah. be performances after the classes on Saturdays, they had a bass there for whoever could provide the proper bass, and I messed around with it a few times, and it wasn't that hard because it was a one string instrument. And so I ended up with that thing, and I guess the only place we played that I remember with that band originally when I was playing the bass was a place called the Sound, and it was in the northern suburbs, just above Highland Park, where the Great Lakes Training Center was, a naval base, right on Lake Michigan. Anyway, they must have had one of those bases there at that bar coffee house, whatever it was. It was they served drinks there. Anyway, but I could sing. I could sing, and the singing for me was way easier. Well, I could do that right away, and I probably sang with a ridiculous southern accent because I wanted to sound authentic, and I. Was also I also did the MC work because I had picked up lines from Lester Flatt at Carnegie Hall or whatever, and from recordings that they made. You know, well, thank you so much and howdy, folks. And anyway, that's where I was at. That's pretty crazy, and.
So what was the name of that ensemble?
Oh, that was the first time we played. I don't remember what our name was. We may not have quite had a name yet. But I did eventually figure out a name. I realized that all the bluegrass bands were named for a mountain or a river, the whatever River Valley Boys. So I thought, well, what kind of rivers do we have here in Chicago? And I looked on a map and I saw the perfect river to name a band after, the Calumet Sag and Sanitary Canal. So we performed as the Calumet Sag and Sanitary Canal River Valley Boys. And it was silly.
No lack of humor there.
And but then I guess our guitar player went off to college. He went off to Madison, Wisconsin. And so, and I was coming along enough on the guitar so that I was playing the guitar. So I played the guitar. And probably, you know, very basic guitar. We played a few jobs. We played on a radio station, and we did a live radio show on I forget the town, some northwest suburban town that was owned by. He was one of the performers on the WGN Barn Dance, and his station was like a country station.
Mm-hmm.
And we did a live show up there. And tape recorded it. I don't think I ever I must have had a copy of it, but I don't anymore. It was probably pretty bad. Anyway, I played the guitar. And then my friend Paul Ostroff, who was a really gifted musician, he played piano from childhood and
mm-hmm.
could read and everything, and was really very good. And then he, when the Beatles came in the 1964, he said, "That's what I'm going to do." So he quit the bluegrass scene. He bought from some kid in his neighborhood whose older brother had played a guitar. He bought a 1953 Telecaster for about $60.
Wow!
This was 1964, so you could do things like that back then. It was possible, and he started playing with a rock band, and before long, he was in with some other friends who I knew. They had a band called the Moving Violations, and they were doing some Rolling Stone songs, and they were blues, and more bluesy than rock, I guess it maybe. But then he ended up with a rock band called Little Boy Blues, and they were pretty well known in Chicago, and they opened big shows at concert halls for big. They opened up for the Yardbirds when Eric Clapton was in the Yardbirds, uh-huh. Came to Chicago, which must have been, I don't know, 66 maybe. And they did the Dick Clark show in California that was always filmed on the beaches. It was so bad, and everybody lip syncing their songs, and they did that too. But he did that for a couple of years, and then he got bored with it, and he focused on playing jazz and classical. He loved classical. He ultimately played I don't remember the piece. It's very commonly done. It's for classical guitar and symphony orchestra, and it's Spanish style.
Flamenco
sound, and but the guitar is classical,
okay.
Rather than flamenco. There's probably some little flamenco echoes in there. Anyway, he performed that with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra at up in Ravinio for a show. So he was very good. He made a living playing for theater productions and that sort of stuff. He played Man of La Mancha like 400 times over a 5-year period.
So at this time, you're teaching still.
Well, I was teaching. Yeah.
And you're playing bluegrass music.
Yeah, I got off on a there. But when he left to play rock and roll, I decided I like the mandolin and like the sound of it and like the idea of playing a mandolin,
and nobody was playing the mandolin in your band.
Like the size and the fact that it was light, and so I decided that's what I was going to focus on, and I bought a little Gibson, probably made in the late teens or I don't know when it was made, a straight A model. It said the Gibson, but no ornamentation beyond that, mm-hmm. And the peg head, and it was just a pretty, pretty low end mandolin. And then I bought my Gibson. It was the second mandolin I bought, and that was the only one I owned until last October. So that was I bought that in 1965. From a music shop in Skokie called Main Music, and it was the history of that instrument is this guy opened up this music store in 64, I believe, which was great timing to sell musical instruments because every kid in America wanted to get play the guitar or the drums or something, and the Beatles helped that a lot. So he was a Gibson dealer, and the initial instruments that he bought from Gibson included this Gibson F12 mandolin they had two of the artist models, the F5, mm-hmm. the fancier one, much more expensive, and the F12. The F12 was just kind of a less ornamented version of the F5. And it had a list price of $495 in 1964 and 5. And it was on the wall there for about a year. In fact, I remember because I went to it. He had a grand opening in that store, and Jethro Burns played there because Jethro lived in Evanston, which is just the store was in Skokie on Main Street. Main Street mm-hmm. runs right into Evanston, so. Jethro was nearby, and the owner of the store, a guy named Milt Chockett, he knew Jethro, and he asked him if he would come and do a couple songs for the opening, and he did. And when he played, he reached down the wall and took down this F-12 that was on the wall, and that's the instrument he played for the grand opening of that music store. And a few months later, it's a mandolin I bought.
If he would have known that Andy Sacker was going to end up with that mandolin, he probably would have.
I paid $125 in cash that I probably got mostly from my mom, and I traded in all the other instruments that I had. My parents had, when I graduated high school in '63, they bought me an Epiphone Country Western model, a very nice. Maybe it's called the Texan. I don't remember the name. The nice mahogany back and sides guitars. And I traded that in, and that old Gibson A-model that I bought somewhere, and my brother's Martin tenor guitar, and $125 in cash. That's what I paid for that Gibson. It was a
Right. You know, with instruments, there's always stories. And I'm sure our producer here, Tracy, has 100 stories about the 5,000 guitars he's bought over his life.
He's got 4,000 right on the racks.
I know, but he's there's always a story, and I love hearing those. So what made somebody? From Chicago, who seems to be comfortable in Chicago. You grew up there your whole life, Cubby fan.
I've got. Before we get to that, Bob, I've still got a couple things. One of the guys that we played with was a guy named Lowell Chiat, and Lowell lived in Skokie, this suburb, and. His father was into stringed instruments, acoustic instruments, and so he knew a lot about guitars, and he'd talk about the Rotomatic tuners and the bindings and things. But he and I, he sang, and he and I did a song together. And this, I had mentioned earlier when I sang with Bob Hoban and Bob, I thought we sounded great.
Mm-hmm.
But this happened about a year or so before that. Lowell and I did a couple songs at a little coffee house that had a little stage. It was in Evanston. It was called the No Exit, you know, the Jean-Paul Sartre. It was on, I think, on Foster Street, right under the L tracks of the L that went, the main north L went out Chicago, went right into Evanston, and went right over. And when we did some country song, again, probably a Stanley Brothers song, I'm not sure. It really sounded great to me, and I thought, well, I can do this bluegrass vocalizing. Anyway,
were you singing tenor or lead or both?
I think he sang above me. uh, Yeah. I think. Pretty sure. Yeah, I didn't realize when I was young that I could sing any tenor stuff. And I still not sure I do it.
I can
sort of do it.
I'm personally envious of what you can sing, but that's just me.
Anyway, throughout my college years, the main thing I was an English major, but the main thing I was interested in was learning how to play the mandolin, and I think I don't remember another band until I was done with college.
Now, where did
there were a number of players, and we used to get together and just do you know, little jams,
right?
Like a Friday night, Saturday nights, whatever.
Now, how about where did Mark Greenberg come in? Wasn't he a Chicago friend?
Yeah.
And there was a banjo player that you used to talk
about. Marshall.
Yeah.
I didn't meet them until I met Larry at one of the University of Chicago Folk Festival weekends. They would have one bluegrass band every festival, and a lot of traditional people have traditional blues and Cajun bands. They would always have a mix of music from all over the place. But they would always have one bluegrass band. And the first one that I went to, which I think was 64, I saw the Lilly Brothers, who were, of course, in Boston for a number of years playing bluegrass up there. They were both from the South. I forget their story, but saw the next one I went to, saw the Stanley Brothers, Ralph and Carter. Carter was still very much alive, although drinking his way to death. And Flat and Scruggs, 67. Jim and Jesse. And they had great bands. Osborne Brothers. Yes, they did. Anyway. But I met, late days in college, I guess, I met Larry Marshall, who was a banjo player from grew up in Buffalo, was going to Cornell at the time. And then he was same year I was. And then he went to grad school at the University of Chicago. So he was living in Chicago. And Mark Greenberg, who grew up in Philly, and Mark I met around 67 or so. I knew who he was because I had seen him at the folk festivals, and he was part of that the committee that put on those festivals.
Mm-hmm.
And but we didn't really become friends until 67, 68, or somewhere around there. And the first real band that I was in was the band that I formed with those guys, with Mark and Larry and Bob Hoban, the guy who I mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Bob played the fiddle. And a guy named Bob Stoltenberg was our bass player. He was a few years older than us, and he was a bebop bass player. And I think he kind of enjoyed what we were doing. And we played. We The first gig we had was at the University of Chicago, and it was their, I think it was freshman orientation week. It was like early September of 67. That was our first gig, and turned out that one of the incoming students at the University of Chicago that day was guy who went on, he was in the Seldom Scene. He's from Connecticut.
Mike Aldridge?
No.
Ben?
No. He was the guitarist and lead and singer. I can't think
Herb of Peterson?
No. He wasn't in it. Herb was out in California. Anyway, I can't think of his name. Anyway, okay, doesn't matter. But we played with some regularity. We had a regular gig. I think it was once every 2 weeks, maybe. Maybe just once a month. It was at the Harper Theater in Harper Court, which is right neighborhood adjacent to the in Hyde Park. South side of Chicago, near the University of Chicago, and we played. We shared the stage with a comedy troupe, an improv comedy troupe called the Baroque Compass Players, and they would do their. They would do a set. We would do a set. They would do a set. We would do a set.
Sounds fun.
It was fun.
Yeah,
it was fun because they were pretty good. They were maybe not quite at the Second City level in terms of talent wise for Chicago, but they were good.
So I have John Duffy, Mike Aldridge, Ben Eldridge, Tom Gray, John Starling.
He was there. That was a different lineup.
They went through many.
But the other guys were all there, but it was a different guitarist.
The originals.
Yeah, he was not the original.
Ben, Michael Aldridge, John Lewis, John Duffy, Tom Gray?
Nope, Tom Gray was a bass player.
Bass player. Banjo, dobro, mandolin guitar player, John Lewis. That's what it says, the original.
Yeah, then he came.
Hall of Fame
it was.
But anyway.
I can't think.
So, you guys are becoming quite a name for yourself in Chicago now.
Yeah, and I should mention our bass player left us after about a year and a half, something like that, because he got accepted into the Stradivarius School of Violin Making in Cremona, Italy, and he went for 2 years. It was like a 2-year course. You
wow.
Do the whole thing, and the class that he was in, he was the only American there. It was like, you know, like 12 students, and his name was that was Bob Stoltenberg. Oh. Anyway, so he left, so we needed a new bass player. So the guys who went to school at the University of Chicago knew of this younger guy, a couple of years younger than us, who was playing electric bass in a band called the Snakeskin and the Pit Vipers. And this young bass player's name, who's from New York, was Clyde Stets.
Oh, no kidding.
So we asked Clyde if he wanted to play bluegrass, and he said, sure. And so he played electric bass, had an old Fender, and so that's how he started out. So I
want you all that are listening just to remember some of these names that are being thrown out, because in future interviews, you're going to hear Clyde Stats' name again, and maybe we'll get a chance to talk to him as well, because he's played in a ton of bands over the years.
Yeah.
And now I was playing jazz with Will Patton's band.
He plays with Asbel regularly, I think.
After all the success, was there one point in Chicago that you said, man, we're going to be the next Flat and Scruggs? Or?
No, I wasn't that crazy to think that. But
from your demure childhood, where you never seemed like you really, you said to yourself, if it was going to be a challenge, you just, it seemed like you found your niche to be able to drive yourself a little bit more.
I guess I did, I did. I mean, I liked doing it, and I liked performing, playing the whole, I liked the whole deal.
You're a great performer. I can attest to that.
Well.
So not to jump too far ahead, and you can back up if you want to.
Well, I can now link together Vermont, because I mentioned Mark Greenberg, who was a guitar player in the first real band I was in, and that was called. But the name of that band was the Lake Country String Band, and Mark was our guitarist.
Much more traditional name than
the Calumet Sag and Sanitary Canal River Valley Boys. <Yes. laughs> Mark grew up in Philadelphia and got into the folk scene and playing and learning how to play bluegrass and blues guitar. He's a great finger player, but great blues player. And anyway, he grew up in Philadelphia and became friends with another kid from Philadelphia, I think a couple of years older than Mark, a guy named Marshall Friedland. And people who are old enough and lived in the Barrie-Montpelier area will very possibly remember Marshall, because he was pretty well known. Marshall went to college at Goddard College in Plainfield, Vermont. And I think he was 2 years older than us, so he was already done with school in the 60s, in the 60s. I graduated in 67. He must have graduated in 65 or 6, I guess. And Marshall was a fabulous banjo and guitarist. But he's probably best known in Vermont for being the winner of the banjo contest.
In Craftsbury?
The Craftsbury Banjo Contest. I think 4 or 5 years in a row, I think he would win every year, and they finally said, "Hey, maybe you can be the judge now, or a judge," and he's got to let some other people have a chance here. And Marshall could play really solid Scruggs style and learn Bill Keith's melodic style. He was just right on that. It was a good. Really good solid player. He had a beautiful 1930s Martin D28 too. And Marshall is no longer among the living. He died about, I don't know what, 8 or 10 years ago maybe. He had some health problems.
He was in Vermont.
Danny Cohn. We'll tell you more about him, because Danny was more keyed into what was going on in central Vermont in the mid-60s, mm-hmm. even 64, 65. Anyway, So Mark Greenberg knew Marshall, and he went up to Vermont one the summer and spent some time up here and came back to Chicago and said, "Oh, this is a really fun place. It's a great place." And so I came up in the summer of 68 for the first time, and spent about 2 weeks. And Mark was renting a cabin in the woods in Worcester,
mm-hmm.
on the Hancock Brook, a brook that flows down off of Mount Worcester, mm-hmm. down towards Route 12.
Yep.
And
turns into Shady Rill at some point,
I guess. Yeah. And came up, had a great time. You know, Vermont's fantastic. It's nothing to do but lay around and put your feet in the swimming hole that they had at this camp, and smoke pot, just have a great time, a lot of fun.
And play music.
Play some music. And that was my first trip up here. And I came every summer after that with my first wife, with Alice. And at least one of those summers, I think 71, we came for the whole summer. We rented with Mark and his wife Joanne. We rented a house just outside of Montpelier, and around that time we decided that we wanted to move here. All of us, and we thought maybe we'd buy a piece of land together.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't be quite so expensive, because we wanted some place that had some acreage, and some place that was in that neck of the woods. Marshall lived up in Woodbury for a while. That's where he was living at mm-hmm. that time. And we were always up that area. So, you know, Woodbury, Callis, Worcester, Marshfield, Plainfield, somewhere up there, East Montpelier maybe. East Montpelier is too expensive, but some of those other places. And so I think the summer of 72 or 73, we actually looked at some properties, and we had plans. We thought we were not interested in a commune, as communes are generally known, but we thought we'd buy a piece of land together and then build just separate houses, or have separate right. houses on it. And this was the time of the back to the land movement, you know, hippies moving right. to the hills. And we bought a piece of land that was, I think, 30 acres. No, I think it was 30 acres, and it was in Callis,
mm-hmm.
Just off of Pekin Brook Road in Callis. If you're going up Route 14, the left turn before you get into the village of East Callis is Pekin Brook Road, and runs up at an angle. It runs all the way up to Maple Corner. And so the first road in, about a mile in off of that, there was a side road, and our land was up there. And in the summer of 74, we had this land. There was a house existing on the land, and Mark and Joanne paid extra for that house, so that was their place. They they expanded it. They put a second floor on it, and so we knew, Alice and I knew, that we were going to have to build our house, and summer of 74, we came and picked a spot, very nice spot, and bought the timber from this guy who had, guy named Bob Hoffman, who had a, he was a like a lumberjack champion. He had a, he had an axe with a silver handle on it. I don't know. He was like a, and he had a sawmill in the woods, not that far away. And we, so we bought our, the winter before I had designed a basic house using information gleaned from the whole Earth catalog on what kind of things you need to do with a house and how to build a house, inexpensive ways of building a house. So we designed and built this hippie house. It was a non-conventional house.
Okay.
It was pole framed, like the way a lot of barns are built, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a 16 by 20 feet, full second floor, with a gambrel roof, you know, two-angle roof. And we built a house in the summer of 75.
You?
Alice and I built it.
Wow, that's impressive.
Yeah. We did the whole thing. We hired somebody to dig the trench for our electric line.
Mm-hmm.
We went from the nearest pole, which was about 1,000 feet away. The house was in a good spot, but it was not a good spot to live in year-round, because in the wintertime we had a 400-foot walk from where we parked the car to the house. And the last part of it was quite steep. You know, we drag our groceries and our laundry up in a little plastic sled.
How romantic, though.
Not romantic. It was stupid. Anyway,
so you must have felt really settled, accomplished, your wife, your new home in Vermont with your buddies.
Well,
and that's a beautiful area. It still is a beautiful area.
Yeah, it is. It's nice. But I only lived there for a year. Alice and I split up. I mean, we were already... I missed part of my story. In 72, I quit my teaching job, which was kind of a pain. And about 2 months after I did that, I got a call from Hoban, my friend Bob Hoban, because he had this band called Rosebud, and he was playing at a regular gig down in Atlanta, Georgia. And he said to come down because they needed a mandolin player. And about a week before, they also had needed a bass player, so they called Chicago again for that and got old Fat Wally Friedrichs, our banjo player that I had played with a few years before that, to play the bass. Wally bought a bass and when he got down there and played the bass. And we played 6 nights a week in one place.
Wow.
Muhlenbrink's Saloon, downtown Atlanta, in a place called Underground Atlanta, which was a kind of tourist trap. Big bar, Muhlenbrink's Saloon, that was famous for making flaming hurricanes. People get fucked up on that drink. You know, it's full of rum and a few other things, and then they put a shot of grain alcohol on top and set it on fire.
Wow.
It's a flaming hurricane. I think it was invented in New Orleans.
Yep.
Right? Is that right? Yeah. You had one of those?
Not with the grain, but you just shot a dark rum on the ones I had, and that was enough.
Yeah. People, yeah, it was quite a scene. We played five shows a night, six nights a week.
So
at this one
club. At that point in time, did you think you were going to make it? You're playing a lot of music, brother.
Well, I made it sort of. I made it to that point.
Yeah.
And that was your living, right?
Well, that's all. Yeah, that was it.
So you quit teaching and you went full time musician.
Yeah, I was for about 6 months, and I left the band.
Were you married at that time?
Yes, and Alice did not go down there with me.
Oh,
just part of the reason.
Yeah. Well, we're going to take a break right here, and we're going to come back, and I think this is just getting good. We'll be back with Mr. Andy Sacker in just a few more minutes.